Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. California Governor Jerry Brown recently unveiled his $179 billion budget plan for the fiscal year that begins in July. Over the next 6 months, lawmakers in Sacramento will negotiate how to allocate the money to various programs. Governor Brown has warned them that with the state projected to run a $1.6 billion deficit by next summer and the uncertainty surrounding Donald Trump's policies, they shouldn't add any more spending. There aren't many changes in this budget because of the unknowns at the federal level. We do know that Governor Brown says he's going to address the budget, the deficit, by slowing the growth in spending on public schools and other social services. He also said the state will not spend more on low-income housing because it's just too expensive. So who will be impacted by this budget? What do we need to know about it? To explore these issues, we're joined by two guests. Chris Haney is Executive Director of the California Budget and Policy Center, a nonpartisan organization that examines the most pressing budget and policy issues, making them accessible and more understandable. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you. We're also joined by Mike Harold, Director of Policy Advocacy at the Western Center on Law and Poverty. That's an organization that fights for justice and system-wide change to secure housing, health care, racial justice, and a strong safety net for low-income Californians. Mike has been advocating for poor families and individuals for more than 20 years. He says the budget is conservative and will not do anything to reduce the state's high poverty rate. In fact, we have one of the highest poverty rates in the country, and it doesn't get as much attention as it deserves. Hi, Mike. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about the uncertainty at the federal level. When you read the reporting about the budget, there's just not that much out there, and that's because there are so many unknowns about what's going to happen at the federal level. So can you explain why that's the case?
That question's to me?
Yes, Mike.
Sure. I think one of the reasons is that one of the great uncertainties in this budget is the future of the Affordable Care Act. And, of course, California robustly implemented the Affordable Care Act when it went into place. We have over, I think, 13 million people now in our Medi-Cal program. We were able to expand that significantly. Our Covered California program has added millions of people, provided health care to millions of people. But the subsidies that people get through Covered California and the funding that allowed us to expand the Medi-Cal program are both in serious question with the Trump administration and with the Republican-controlled Congress. The numbers vary, but I think, you know, we're looking at potential impacts if fully devolved, if it was fully reversed and repealed, you know, that the state could lose as much as $16 billion. Yeah. And millions of people would either lose care or have that care significantly roll back. So that would create, you know, I think everyone can understand the size and magnitude of the budget hole that would be created for the state if that were to occur. It would force the state into making incredibly difficult choices. I think it's fair to say that we don't have $16 billion sitting around spare that we can put into those programs to make up those cuts. So, you know, I think in fairness to the governor, I think, you know, this budget, I think everyone anticipated that we were going to see a sort of baseline budget, as we would call it. In other words, a budget that basically is just whatever's required by current law and maybe a little bit less, but certainly nothing more. And that's exactly what we got in January. We got a budget that was very conservative in its numbers, very conservative in terms of its fiscal outlooks, and really not promoting any major government expansions and actually going backwards on some things that we plan to do, that we agreed to do last year.
Going backwards where?
Well, there were two areas that I can think of. Chris may know additional ones, but two that I know of. One is that we were going to expand child care. There was a multi-year plan to phase up you know, increase the number of availability of child care for low-wage workers in the state. And the governor put a quote-unquote pause on that effort. And then another place was there was a major effort last year by the Senate to deal with the issues of mentally ill homeless persons in California called the No Place Like Home Initiative. One program in there was a $45 million matching fund to encourage local governments to engage in housing and advocacy work that would help people get onto the federal SSI program and help them get into permanent affordable housing. It's a highly effective model, and many cities, counties are running it, Alameda, San Francisco, Los Angeles, just to name a couple, and are showing really good results with it. So the state put in $45 million, and the governor proposes to pull all that back. In fact, they've not implemented the program at all, and they've not, and they're not planning to. At least that's what the governor's January budget proposed.
And why don't you jump in here, Chris? I mean, again, this budget, it's not much different because we don't know what's going to happen at the federal level. But this budget is a really important indicator of state priorities. So, what really stood out for you in this budget?
Well, I think I would second everything Mike just said there, more so than this administration has faced at any point over its two terms. There's more uncertainty at this point in the budget process than there has, even more so than during the Great Recession in some respects. And so it's actually hard to see what the priorities are in the budget because the budget essentially makes very minimal new investments. The only place where there's really a discretionary choice made about spending additional money is in the higher education arena, where the governor has is proposing to continue some small increases year to year in funding for the University of California and California State University systems. And that's been part of a multi-year effort to increase funding to those systems, but requiring them also to meet some stipulations that the governor has put on them in terms of accepting more students in California, making sure they're matriculating more quickly, increasing access and affordability, those types of things. So that's the only real place where there's new investments. Otherwise, everything else is basically sort of on autopilot at its current levels, or in some cases is actually being reduced by some amount.
Well, Chris, you're the executive director of the California Budget and Policy Center, and you work to make the budget and policy issues more understandable. A lot of people don't know how budgets work. They don't know what's in budgets, and they're so, so important. So I want to put out the phone number early. If you have any questions about the budget in California, Jerry Brown just unveiled the $179 billion budget plan for the fiscal year. There were protests in the weeks leading up to this announcement by a number of groups working for social service organizations, home care workers, people with disabilities, union members, people saying that there needs to be more of a focus on social services at a time when so many people are struggling to make ends meet in California. And if you have any questions about what's in the budget, if you work with any groups that are affected by the budget, what would you like to talk about in terms of how you're affected by this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Chris, can you also talk about what California is facing? Because Governor Brown says that there's going to be a $1.6 billion deficit by next summer.
Right. So the way that the governor has usually approached his January budget release has been to be extremely conservative with his projections about the revenue that the state will collect. And that's based on his usually saying he's expecting slower growth or slow growth in the state's economy. And this year is no different, although he's being even more conservative, and he's projecting a slowdown that leads to a $1.6 billion deficit. It's important to remember that that's one projection. The Legislative Analyst Office, the independent body that serves the state legislature, had its own projection out a couple of months back and was projecting that there would be maybe as much as a $3 billion surplus going into this year, next year's budget. So there's some flexibility there, and all of that will depend on what happens with the economy in the coming months. And if there is indeed more space, because the economy does better, then that will free up the state leaders to actually make some investments that we're not seeing in this budget so far. But there again, that plays into what happens at the federal level, what's the potential budget hole that results from federal actions, and then what, you know, do state leaders then do to try to fix that problem, and what else does that squeeze out? So we're just facing, you know, a whole bunch of questions that we know very little about here in January and February.
And what would you add to that, Mike?
I think Chris's analysis is right. I think in my conversations with members of the Budget Committee and the staff that work for them, I mean, I think there's two things happening. I think there's a wait and see attitude, I think, is permeating everything in the Capitol. But I think quietly, you know, the staff are preparing, I think, to be able to augment the governor's budget. They are working on proposals that would increase social service funding and I think try to restore some of the proposed cuts that the governor put out in the January budget. I think there's a lot of interest in the Capitol right now around the issue of affordable housing. I think in the coming weeks we're going to see a plethora of legislation introduced to try to address that issue. So I think there's a desire by many legislators to not forget about the needs of real Californians. That, yes, we have a new administration in Washington. The administration is very unpredictable, I think even more unpredictable than we would have guessed when the governor put out his budget. But having said that, we can't stop, you know, working to try to fix the problems that Californians have of poverty, inequality, right, lack of affordable housing. Those things still have to be addressed.
Right, and we should keep reminding everyone that Democrats have a supermajority in the Assembly and the Senate in Sacramento, which means they can pass a law, they can pass a tax increase without a single Republican vote. And, you know, I'd like to hear both of you talk about why is it that, you know, we have a very high poverty rate in California. People really struggle to make ends meet. In fact, there was an article about jobs that are being created in California by Susan Shelley of the LA Daily News. And, you know, she says a lot of jobs have been created in California, but the fact is they just don't pay much. You know, a lot of people make minimum wage in the state. And Mike, what are your thoughts on this? Because Democrats control the state, and yet we have an incredibly high poverty rate.
Well, I think one thing to remember is that while, yes, Democrats have a two-thirds majority, the reality is that most of the state budget is spoken for before we ever sit down in a budget committee or take a look at what the state's needs and priorities are. I mean, almost half the state's revenue by the Constitution goes to public schools, and the legislators really can't change that. And then, of course, we have, by national standards, we have a fairly robust health and human services program which the Medi-Cal program in particular is a very large program that eats up a lot of money, and that's an ongoing entitlement that people get in our state. We're glad that it's an entitlement and that it can't be taken away from people, but it costs a lot of money. And so when you begin to look at all the things where the state has committed resources in advance, at the end of the day, the amount of money that they actually have that they get to move around and perhaps put towards poverty programs is pretty small. And there's a lot of competition for it, and there's a lot of powerful interest in Sacramento, much more powerful than low-income advocacy groups that are fighting for that money. And so, yeah, I think the legislature invariably gets caught where their wishes and desires and the things that they would like to do are always truncated by the lack of availability of real resources that they can put towards problems.
Chris, how would you explain it?
Yeah, the question of why California's poverty rate is higher has a lot of complicated answers involved in it. But I'd point to a couple of things. One, you already pointed to, which is how job creation in California has been changing over time. And over several decades, and actually in particular since the end of the Great Recession, the job creation that's occurring in California at lower wage levels is actually occurring at even lower wages adjusted for inflation than it was previously. And so we keep making it harder and harder in terms of the available wages and protections for low-income workers, at the same time as we're concentrating wealth up at the very highest end of the spectrum. So our wealth inequality and our income inequality keeps growing over time. I'd also note that there are some of this isn't by accident. Some of this is about a series of policy changes that have been made. As Mike was just saying, while the state does more than a lot of other states in terms of its safety net and human services, we have been making cuts or not built back from prior cuts that we've had to made during economic downturns. And that's leaving folks who are vulnerable in even more vulnerable positions, particularly in a state where housing costs are high, child care costs are high, and therefore it makes it even harder for them to make ends meet. So some of this is also about policy choices that we would need to reverse in order to make a difference for these folks.
Chris Haney is Executive Director of the California Budget and Policy Center, and Mike Harold is Director of Policy Advocacy at the Western Center on Law and Poverty. Today we are talking about California Governor Jerry Brown's budget. It's not much different from the last one because there are so many uncertainties at the federal level. It's a $179 billion budget. That's a massive budget. It's important to point out that more than 7 in 10 federal dollars that flow through California's state budget support health and human services for kids, seniors, and others. And we just don't know what's going to happen with Donald Trump and the Affordable Care Act, for example. So there's a lot of questions that have yet to be answered. And if you have any questions or comments about the budget, it's a really important document. We need to spend more time figuring out who makes these decisions, how the money is distributed, taxes. There's so many questions around these issues. And we'd love to hear from you if you work for an organization that's affected by the budget. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. My original question was going to be to ask your guests if they might be able to give a little bit lengthier perspective on how we've gotten to this point in 2017 where just take an example. Students at the University of California have to pay now tens of thousands of dollars to go to college, whereas 20, 25, 30 years ago, it was a very minimal amount to go to the UC or state system. So that was one thing. And then in the course of, if they could even address what's happened, I think it leads into another question that just arose while you were talking, that is taxes. What's happened in the last 10 or 15 or 20 years? I can think of some things, Proposition 13, which goes way bit further back than that. But I'm just wondering what's happened in terms of taxes or revenues, despite the fact that the Democrats have these majorities. Why is it that we've not been able to keep pace in terms of revenues, I guess, with regard to taxation, to be able to pay for these programs adequately? And Medi-Cal is not paid for adequately. There's a lot of money spent, but doctors' reimbursement rates are so low they don't even join Medi-Cal. So if you can make sense out of that, that's it.
Well, yeah, and a lot of people said that the budget fails to lift SSI recipients out of poverty. Mike, do you want to take that one first?
Yeah, I think I'd like to get to that issue about SSI, but I will just kind of quickly note, I think on issues, you know, I mean, I went to the University of California. I'm going to date myself if I say what year I graduated. But let me just say that in that time, I never took out a single student loan. And, you know, I don't come from a wealthy family. My dad was a state worker, as middle class as you can get. And but it was a time when the state made a more robust investment in higher education. We've pulled back from that over time. And I think a lot of that did start with Prop 13. But then I would note that, you know, I think Prop 98, which was the K-12 school funding proposal, did, you know, have, I think, a dramatic effect on limiting the things that the state could do over time. And I think you've seen a number of government programs that used to be more robust have atrophied. I think higher education is one of them. Another issue, I think, has been the growth of the state prison system, which used to be in the low billions and now is $7 or $8 billion in general fund dollars being spent every year. So there are have been some programs that have grown over time and others that have shrunk. It used to be 20, 30 years ago that we would provide grants for families with children, better known as welfare or now called CalWORKs, that were nearly at the federal poverty level. Now a family of three in California gets a grant that's worth 43% of the federal poverty level. On SSI, there was a series of cuts that occurred during the Schwarzenegger administration and the first year or two of the Brown administration that literally dropped a million disabled and elderly Californians below the poverty level. So when we look at the poverty numbers and the growth that we've seen in recent years, they are on that issue, you can directly attribute a million people literally to policy choices, budget decisions that were made by the legislature and the governor that have added those numbers up.
Can we stick with this one for a minute? Because we have a lot of listeners living with a disability on SSI, and California has the highest rate of poverty in the country. It's about 20%. 75% of all people living in poverty in the state are people of color. A third of all Californians living in deep poverty are kids. Poverty affects 29% of people with disabilities, immigrants 31%. And this is just shocking in a state with so much money. According to the East Bay Times, the maximum SSI benefit for an individual is $895 a month.
Right. That's about, based on the new poverty data that we just saw literally yesterday, it's now down to 89% of the federal poverty level. When the cut started, we were at about 101 or 102 percent. The Budget Center actually has a really good piece on this that they put out last year that kind of documents how this has gone down over time. And while we have been able to restore cuts for a wide variety of programs in the last 4 or 5 years, we have literally not restored one penny of the money that we took from the SSI recipients over those years. So they got their grants cut by $77. And the state eliminated permanently all cost of living adjustments. Now, last year, the governor did propose, and we did get a very, very, I mean, $6 increase in the state amount for a cost of living adjustment, but that still didn't address the $77 a month that was taken out of every individual's grant over those number of years. The state has literally saved billions of dollars on the backs of SSI recipients and continues to do so in this budget. And so I think that's one of the great inequalities that we're seeing.
I mean, this is just shameful. I just want to quote two people in this article. Tony, an SSI recipient from Concord, says, "There are days when I only have bread to eat." Lisa, an SSI recipient from Bay Point, saw her monthly income rise $5 this year. And she says, $5 means that I can maybe afford to do 2 loads of laundry. I still don't have enough money to survive. We have gone without food for days. I cannot afford even the minimum. Chris, can you, I mean, this again, this state is awash in money. So why is this happening? I mean, what can people do to put the pressure on politicians, Democrats in Sacramento to maybe $20 more a month? I mean, how can you live on $895 a month on SSI? You can't.
Well, in answering that question, I want to connect Greg's question from earlier to what Mike just said, because this essentially comes back to while it looks like the state is awash in money, and $179 billion, of course, is a huge amount of money when you talk about a state budget, there are a lot of demands and competition for those funds. And we as a state have made choices that are restricting tax revenues on things like the property tax and the ability of the sales tax to keep up with the economy. We have made choices to earmark certain parts of the budget for certain priorities, including K through 14 education and a state rainy day fund. And while there you can make good arguments for some of those choices, they squeeze out the ability to improve conditions for low-income people in particular in programs like SSI and SSP. So this comes back to a question about what we do on the resource front, which is about revenues. And are we as a state, and will state leaders finally take on bigger issues of tax reform that are actually holding back the state's ability to make the kinds of investments it used to make, like in our higher education systems and in a more robust safety net? And until we take on those issues, those services that are not earmarked and protected in the Constitution are going to continue to get the short end of budget proposals.
So many people are active right now, and they want to know what they can do. Most of the activism has really focused on the federal level, California politicians who are voting for Donald Trump's nominees, for example. What can people do at the state level to put pressure on state politicians? Chris?
Yeah, well, I think much the way your couple of examples of people trying to live on SSI, SSP, the people need to tell the story about what it means when their services are cut. So if representatives from California want to actually take what is largely an ideologically based vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act and yank health care away from 5 million people who are getting that coverage who weren't previously, then the people who aren't receiving that coverage need to tell their stories, make their voices heard, and hold people accountable for those kinds of decisions.
Chris Haney is Executive Director of the California Budget and Policy Center, and Mike Harold is Director of Policy Advocacy at the Western Center on Law and Poverty. Today we are talking about California Governor Jerry Brown's budget. He has received a lot of positive media coverage because he said he's going to take on Donald Trump, but his budget hasn't received that much attention, and we just don't spend that much time talking about people living in poverty in this state or people living on $895 a month, an SSI benefit, people who cannot even afford bread or they only have bread to eat in a state like California. So we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on the priorities of state officials and what is most effective to put pressure on them to change priorities to ensure that people do not go hungry in a state like California? This is your call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of Donald Trump's executive order on immigration, banning people from seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States. We're getting so many stories about people who needed to come to this country to have major surgeries, and now they're in limbo. We're also going to talk about Donald Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court and how the media are reporting on future rulings on key issues affecting affirmative action, LGBT rights, and abortion. That's tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about California Governor Jerry Brown's $179 billion budget. There are not many changes in the budget because there are so many unknowns at the federal level. We just don't know what's going to happen at the federal level. But there's a lot to talk about, just priorities. How is the money allocated? Why is it that so many people live in poverty in the state of California? In fact, in Kern County, where there are a number of protests to pressure politicians to keep the Affordable Care Act in place, over 30% of children there live in poverty. We're talking about these issues with Chris Haney, Executive Director of the California Budget and Policy Center, and Mike Harold, Director of Policy Advocacy at the Western Center on Law and Poverty. And if you have a question or comment, about the budget, about priorities in this state. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Joanne in San Francisco. Hi, Joanne. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much. I tuned in a little late, but right when you were talking about living on $8.95 a month. So I just want to make a couple of quick comments, and then I will hang up and get ready for work. So my mother, who is long beyond retirement age, must work full-time because she cannot live like millions of other Americans on $8.50 a month. And I get so many people asking me, and I'm talking about people who I work with, who are about, would consider themselves as left-leaning, anti-Trump, thoughtful as you can be, and they are, but why doesn't she retire? They work, as I do, for a city agency. They get a pension. She has no, most Americans, she has no pension.
Right.
To get her teeth fixed, what is it called, for people over 65, Medi-Cal or Medicare, whatever it is, anyway, they don't pay for dental. She can, $8.50 is even a month to pay her rent. Now, because we all help together, we live an okay life, but I just cannot believe people ask me, you know, why doesn't she, and I always say, could you live on $8.50 a month?
Mm.
And it's just unbelievable. And I'm talking about right-thinking people who, you know, I just don't, do they think that all Americans have pensions? I just don't get it. Anyway, I just wanted to voice that, vent a little bit, because I'm asked it so often.
Joanne, can I ask, how old is your mom and what is she doing?
She's in her late 70s, and I'm not comfortable sharing that. But
okay.
She works for, you know, it's like a regular job.
Mm-hmm. In her late 70s.
Yes, and she will probably work, as I probably will. I will get a pension, so I actually might. But she will never. And, I mean, it's lucky she has, like, good health, and we all chip in together, and we do some things in life. But I'm just utterly amazed how often I'm asked, why doesn't she retire? I just don't understand. And as I said, I'm talking about highly educated, you know, seriously left-wing people. Do they actually think that all Americans get pensions? Anyway, you hear my frustration.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And, I mean, it's because most of these stories are not in the media. I mean, I read the Times, the Chronicle every day, and it's pretty rare. Once in a while, you'll get a good feature on the struggles that people are facing, but it's pretty rare. I mean, for California, the focus is on Silicon Valley and technology and high salaries and the billionaires that live in our state, but we don't spend enough time talking about struggles. And this is so important, Chris, because 10,000 people turn 65 every single day in this country, and the majority of the new jobs that are being created do not have benefits and do not have pensions.
Right, and I think this is a story that's going to become a much bigger story in the years to come.
Yep.
We have a huge senior poverty wave that's about to come that we're only just now really beginning to realize. And it's, again, a story about policy choices. Yes, you know, everyone knows that as the baby boomers move increasingly to retirement age, that the demographic wave is coming. But within that, we have a much larger number of people over 65 or who will be over 65 who are going to be facing conditions of poverty or economic hardship, and it's because of policy choices that have taken away pensions, that have reduced retirement benefits, left people with less in terms of health care benefits, and it's going to be particularly bad for seniors who have one income, which tends to affect senior women more. And the numbers are going to grow as we have more and more people reaching retirement age.
Mike, what would you add to that? And because there's so much focus on the federal government, I mean, with so many people don't pay attention to what's going on in their backyards, are many people in Sacramento, or politicians, do we have many advocates for older people who cannot make ends meet?
We don't have enough. I would note there is a new coalition, in fact, been around for a year or two now, called Californians for SSI. You can find their website at ca4ssi.org, and it's sprung up for exactly this reason, because there were not very many people besides myself and a couple of other people who would actually go to budget hearings and say, we need more money for people on SSI. They're struggling and suffering, and we're paying no attention to them. So, you know, I would encourage people who really care about that to join Californians for SSI. And you know, I think, you know, I think the legislature is a little bit more interested in providing additional funding for SSI recipients. I think the governor is the one that needs a push, and I think if people were going to place their advocacy interests or time out there, I mean, writing a letter to the governor and telling him about their personal circumstances would be really helpful. He, you know, for whatever faults he may have, he does work hard and he actually does pay attention to information. And so I think, you know, the more that we can kind of communicate that message to him directly, the better the likelihood that we could get something accomplished in that arena. I would also just say that these issues around poverty for low-income folks, seniors, disabled, and others, you know, there's not one solution to any of these. And while income is a really important component of that, also trying to limit the cost that people face. And so one of those major costs, obviously, is the cost of housing. And, you know, there is, I think, the governor has been very, very reluctant to have a permanent source of funding, for example, for affordable housing. He's not really been a major advocate for that. And, in fact, he's, in my judgment, sometimes been guilty of putting out numbers around the cost of affordable housing that really aren't accurate. He makes it sound like the subsidy amounts are extremely large and only benefit a single individual family, which is really not the case. Most people who live in affordable housing live there 3 to 5 years, and then they move on, and another family gets it. So it's really like an infrastructure investment is the way we need to look at affordable housing, and instead, it's just looked at this as really high cost. You know, costs $500,000 to build an affordable unit. We just can't afford that. All the people will never be able to build our way out of the affordable housing problem, so why even try?
Right.
But the outcome of that means that people just get further and further into the hole, and more of their income gets taken to pay for market rate housing.
I'm glad you brought this up. Can you quickly elaborate a bit more on that? Because the LA Times had a story about Governor Brown saying that the state will not spend more on low income housing because it's just too expensive to build. Brown proposed no new funding for low income housing subsidies in the budget and said he would not support any housing legislation that would increase budgetary spending. Instead, he said he would support new laws that would make it easier to build new homes, lower cost to develop low-income housing, and provide financial incentives for cities that meet housing production goals. What does this mean exactly?
Well, it means we're not going to fix the problem at all, because unless there's a source of subsidy revenue to get the cost of these units down to the income levels that we're talking about, people on SSI, if they really shouldn't be spending more than 30% of their income. So that means they should be paying a rent in the neighborhood of $270 a month. And if they and to get to that level, we have to have a unit that's virtually 100% subsidized. The private market is never going to be able to provide rents at $270 a month. So, you know, that's the problem, I think, is the governor has made this argument that it's just too expensive, but I think we're going to get to a point where the cost of having people living on the streets or in substandard housing where they get sick and they end up going to public hospitals, we're increasingly seeing that the cost of doing nothing is more expensive than the solution. And the governor, I don't think, is quite there on that issue. But I think we are seeing other sectors where we now recognize that that's the case.
And before we let you go, Chris, with Ben Carson running HUD, what are your thoughts on the federal government playing a role in subsidizing affordable housing?
Well, I'm not optimistic that we're going to see more federal activity. It seems much more likely that we're going to see less.
Yeah.
You know, the primary ways that the federal government's involved in affordable housing at the local level now is through housing vouchers that it provides to low-income individuals. I wouldn't be surprised to see federal proposals, at least, that attack those vouchers in some fashion. And I think some of the other ways through things like the Community Development Block Grant, which is a block grant that goes to local governments to help them build affordable housing and do other community development projects, that's been every administration in Congress for years has been letting that program languish, and I would expect this administration, if anything, proposes to eliminate it or cut it drastically. So I'm not looking for solutions out of HUD here, unfortunately, which makes it all the more imperative that the state take on the affordable housing issue along the lines of some of the ways that Mike said. There are some other solutions that we could do through the tax code that would help individuals as they are trying to figure out how to make housing more affordable. And it also goes to some of the other costs that are in people's budgets. So, you know, subsidized child care and the Affordable Care Act and Medi-Cal and providing people with health care means that you're reducing their costs in other parts of their family budget, even if California is a higher cost place to live. So we have to think about that in the context of affordable housing.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Chris Haney, Executive Director of the California Budget and Policy Center. And Mike Harold is with us for the rest of the show, Director of Policy Advocacy at the Western Center on Law and Poverty. Today we are talking about California Governor Jerry Brown's $179 billion budget. There aren't many changes in the budget because of the unknowns at the federal level. And Mike, we have a question on Facebook. I'd like to hear how corporate profits kept offshore contribute to the budget crisis and the lack of funds for the growing poor. And before you jump in on that, the AP had an interesting story about why tax revenues are down in California. According to the Department of Finance, California's three biggest income sources, personal income taxes, sales taxes, and corporate taxes, are all coming in below projections because growth in wages has been dominated by workers at the lower end of the wage spectrum who pay lower taxes, including people getting a boost to comply with a new minimum wage. And then, according to the story, corporate taxes are also not as high.
Right. You know, I'm not an expert on this subject, but I think the phenomenon of the offshoring of corporate profits to avoid tax revenue is mostly impacting the federal budget. I mean, having said that, of course, the degree to which that was to be remedied would make more funds available at the federal level that would then, you know, come down to the state of California that we could use. The truth is that corporate taxes have been declining for many years in California as a revenue source, and the personal income tax has risen as the major and dominant source of revenue that the state general fund relies on. I think what Chris talked about earlier, that and what I think the AP story references, is that the growth in employment, while it's good to see a lower unemployment rate in our state, the truth is that most of those jobs don't pay a living wage. And so there's not very much tax revenue generated off those because lower wage workers don't generate sales tax, I mean state income tax, because their incomes are just too low. It's really only until you get somewhere in the $40,000 range where you even begin to have any kind of substantial state taxes being paid. So it's nice that we have a very good progressive income tax for low-wage workers because they need that money to pay the rent and other costs we've been talking about. But as a practical matter, the growth of employment doesn't translate into personal income tax revenue. Now, I would just add, though, I mean, I'm a little bit of a skeptic about the way that the governor's has proposed and suggested that the personal income taxes are declining. We get a lot of revenue from higher income earners, and we have a lot of them in our state. And I do think that you're going to see a bump in the amount of taxes that they're going to pay because of the significant rise in the stock market that occurred after the election. And so, people are going to be paying capital gains taxes, I think, more than we probably anticipated. And I think most folks around Sacramento think that the governor's numbers in January are too low and that we will get a bump and increase in revenue as we go forward.
All right. Well, thank you for that question. We have another tax question from Jim in Sunnyvale. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment from those of us that are paying the property taxes. My housing costs have quintupled in the last 30 years, but my salary's probably doubled in that same period of time. And I just went through the painful process of remodeling and am now being told by the state that the that my property is going to be assessed, you know, based on $1,000 a square foot, which is three times what I spent on it. And so now I'm looking for where I have to move when I finish construction of my house because I cannot afford to pay those property taxes for the rest of my life. And this is to subsidize public employees that, in my experience, work a fraction as hard as I work and have not been laid off, unlike me, as I'm an engineer.
Mike, do you know much about property taxes?
Well, it's what I would say is that it's really not probably the state technically that's doing that. It's probably your county assessor who is evaluating that the improvements that you've made to your property are going to raise the value of that. And then, of course, that becomes your new tax base from which the Prop 13 tax applies. You can contest that. It doesn't mean you'll win. You can certainly challenge that. That is the way the system works. And we also know that many large landowners, property owners, people who owned large businesses during the recession went to county assessors and actually had the value of their property reduced so that their property tax would go down. So assessors, I think, are still sort of feeling the licking their wounds from some of those losses, and I think are now more aggressively acting within the law to increase property values when they see those opportunities, and it sounds like you may be an unfortunate victim of that.
Mm. Well, thank you for the call. We have an email from Kathleen at the Alameda County Food Bank. She writes, the food bank has been advocating for the restoration of SSI since it was slashed during the recession. Many of our clients are on SSI and have to turn to the food bank because SSI is not enough to survive on. It's important to note that in California, being on SSI makes you automatically ineligible to receive CalFresh, also known as food stamps. California is the only state where that's the case. While a lot of advocacy energy is focused at the federal level right now, we think it's more important than ever to pay attention to the state budget and demand we improve our social safety net. Yes, thank you so much, Kathleen. I think so many people are focused on the federal level, which is very important, but really local action is so, so important. And I am going to propose a show about this because I don't think I knew that about people being ineligible to receive food stamps. That is very important. So thank you so much for that email. Let's go next to Leah in San Francisco. Hi, Leah. Hello, Leah? Is Leah on the road? All right.
BART train.
Yeah, maybe on a BART train. Leah's question is actually connected to Lisa's question. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I guess I'm by the way, I'm on SSI. And
sorry, Lisa, you got cut off. Can you start over?
I'm on SSI, too, and I think I brought up on your call several years ago that we couldn't get food stamps. But anyhow, I'm curious why it is that Massachusetts was able to pass something equivalent to the Affordable Care Act, and would it be more affordable if California tried to go to full Medicare for everybody?
Well, it passed under Schwarzenegger. He vetoed it, what was it, Mike, two or three times, right?
Yeah, and then failed once. They're talking about a single-payer system for health care, and I think it's been, you know, a long-cherished dream of people who are advocates for health care. It doesn't – I'm not an expert in this, but my friend Anthony Wright, who runs Health Access, I have heard him explain in a way that I can probably not do for your audience that the apparently the current way that our system is funded from the federal government wouldn't allow us to adapt it to a single-payer system. So as long as the ACA sort of stays in place, doesn't seem like that's going to be something that's going to be in the offing right away. I would note, I believe, that Senator Bernie Sanders did recently actually propose, I think, a national model, though, based on that. And if the ACA is to be repealed and then replaced, you know, some might hope that perhaps that might take its place. I would think that that's probably unlikely given who's in charge in Washington right now, but it's never hurts to continue to pursue things that make economic sense, because a single-payer system does reduce some of the costs of the system and it keeps costs under control.
Well, now that we have a Democratic governor, Mike, do you think that Democrats in Sacramento, the same Dems that voted for this under Schwarzenegger, would vote for it under Brown?
No, well, they might, but I think if Anthony Wright is correct and the financing scheme won't allow us to use the funds that way, it's sort of a political non-starter. I just don't see it as gaining a lot of currency. If I could say something really quickly on this issue about food stamps for SSI recipients, this is what is called in the parlance cash out. So what California did some 20 or 30 years ago, 30 years ago now, is that for the ease of administration, they gave every SSI recipient a $10 boost in their income in lieu of being able to get federal food stamps. And the idea really was that we didn't want to have people having to apply for SSI, and then we send out a check for SSI, and then we have to do a whole completely separate process for determining their eligibility for food stamps. So it was really sort of a thing to try to reduce the size of the administrative part of the running these programs. But over time, that $10 has just lost its value completely. Many recipients now, if they were able to apply for food stamps in California, would be getting in the neighborhood of $70. So we are literally leaving hundreds of millions of dollars in Washington, D.C. that we could be providing for SSI recipients in California. So this is something I think the legislature is getting increasingly interested in. I think there's a bit of a pause right now on the effort at the state level, simply, again, as we're watching how things play out in Washington. But I think it's on the minds of a lot of people. I know the administration is well-versed on this subject, the Brown administration, and is thinking about this, and I think would love to find an opportunity to reverse that policy.
Mike, just quickly, pressure works. We're seeing that at the federal level. People are protesting outside of Dianne Feinstein's home, Chuck Schumer's home. We saw that Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, Republican senators, are going to vote no on the Betsy DeVos nomination to be Secretary of Education. They both have said it's because their offices were flooded with tens of thousands of phone calls. What is most effective in Sacramento, just quickly?
The same thing. People, members are, and legislators, the governor, are very susceptible to public pressure. And I think we need to be doing the same exact things here in Sacramento.
Mike Harold is Director of Policy Advocacy at the Western Center on Law and Poverty, an organization that fights for justice and system-wide changes to secure housing, health care, and a strong safety net for low-income Californians. Mike, thanks for your work and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be talking about Donald Trump's executive order on immigration. We'll also talk about his nominee for the Supreme Court. How are the media reporting on his record and the court's future rulings on very important issues affecting affirmative action, LGBTQ rights, and abortion? That's tomorrow at 10. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Thanks for joining us.